It's now common practice at any gathering of significance to acknowledge the traditional owners of the land where we stand. In more formal gatherings, as doubtless you've experienced, a local elder might welcome you to country. Well, Welcome to Country is the title of a new book by Professor Marcia Langton, writer, anthropologist, and as she proudly declares in her Twitter biography, a descendant of the fighting Imam of Queensland. The subtitle to the book is A Travel Guide to Indigenous Australia, and it's a remarkably generous work at a time when 60,000 years of sovereignty remains unacknowledged in our national constitution, and when every measure of health and well-being puts our first Australians at the bottom of the heap. For the year that made me, Marcia Langton, welcome.
Thanks, Hugh.
Why have you written this book?
The Hardy Grant publishers asked me to do it. But I have been thinking about it for a very long time. There was a Lonely Planet guide to Indigenous Australia many years ago, but this Welcome to Country is of an entirely different order. And also, I think what is special about this book is that it's so beautifully designed and illustrated, and the publishers themselves did obviously an enormous amount of work getting all the permissions for the photographs and artworks that are used.
Yeah, it's interesting about the permissions, because one of the things that you are doing here is you're introducing the interested reader into all kinds of cultural issues that they may not be fully aware of. It's very accessible, it's easy to read, but among them are things like, you know, how you should approach things like taking photographs and what is permissible to take photographs of, you know, even when it's permissible or appropriate to ask questions and when it's better just to sit quietly and observe. It really is a journey into understanding.
Well, I'm glad you think so, because I had general guidance from the publishers. They gave me some topics that they wanted covered, and then it, you know, developed into me saying what I felt I really needed to say. I mean, because people say so often that we need cultural awareness training in our organisation. And, you know, I've been to a lot of these sessions. But the things that are not said are all of the things that I have said in this book. So I'm very happy to have got it all off my chest.
So a lot of those cultural awareness things, do you think they miss the point or they're overly complicated or...?
Well, I got the opportunity here, for instance, to talk about language rules. You know, and as you say, you know, the protocols of when to take photographs and, you know, under what circumstances, when to ask questions and when not to. And when I was writing it, the traditional owners of Uluru it was actually the board of Uluru Kathajuda National Park announced that the public walking on to Uluru would cease in October 2019. And there was quite a bit in the media about it, and I thought, well, you know, I was at the handover ceremony and I worked on the Lake Amadeus land claim just to the north, and I used to drive down to Mutitjulu and pick people up and take them to the land claim hearings, and I camped with them for many weeks there. And I thought, you know how they feel about this. I should say what is not going to be said in the newspaper article. So I got the opportunity to talk about how, apart from the cultural matter, and they've never ever wanted people to walk on the rock, and there are sacred sites there, but I got to talk about how people get so very upset about people dying on their country, and there's such a high number of people who've died climbing up the rock. There's even a cemetery at the base of the rock. And people get upset, really upset about people dying on their country, and they don't want to be held responsible for these terrible incidents. So
that's an interesting point there, in the sense that people go there and they're unaware of the degree to which traditional owners are themselves taking a sense of responsibility for their well-being, and that if anything happens to them, that becomes a personal burden to the traditional owners.
Very much so. And in fact, when people talk about their ranger programs and their environmental programs, they use the term caring for country. And that incorporates not just environmental management practices and conservation of flora and fauna, but also taking responsibility for the people on your country and keeping them safe. So in the sign at the base of Uluru, erected by the Anangu people, It states, "Please don't climb. We, the Anangu traditional owners, have this to say. Uluru is sacred in our culture. It is a place of great knowledge. Under our traditional law, climbing is not permitted. This is our home. As custodians, we are responsible for your safety and behaviour. Too many people do not listen to our message. Too many people have died or been hurt, causing great sadness. We worry about you and we worry about your family." So I think that statement just sums it all up very beautifully.
Now, one of the things about this book, which comes clearly through, is that you are encouraging people to travel to Indigenous Australia, to be curious, to involve themselves in their own journey of discovery, whether they're overseas tourists or if they live in Australia, possibly for generations, to understand more about, you know, the country that we live in. Do you think that there is now a deeper level of openness to the curiosity that non-Indigenous Australians have about our pre-European past?
Oh, yes, very much so. And I've watched it grow over the last 40 years. And there are hundreds of thousands of visitors to some of these places that are listed in this book, particularly Uluru, Cartajuda, Kakadu, but increasingly places like the Bungle Bungles or Brunalulu in the Kimberley, Cape York, and there are Aboriginal-owned resorts now. So this guide is well timed to meet the need of that market.
And it does also bring the prospect of jobs to Indigenous people on their own land. And this has been a theme that you have pursued for decades now.
Yes. I think it's one of the purposes of the book is to let the travelling public know that there are wonderful Indigenous-owned businesses all over the country where people can have a first-hand encounter with Aboriginal culture or food or environmental management, because in many places the Aboriginal Ranger programs provide the tour guides. And I would love to see more Aboriginal tourism projects, because one of the great advantages of viable tourism businesses for Aboriginal landowners is that they get to stay on their own country and they get to raise their families on their own country and teach their children about their culture in situ. That's all that people have ever wanted, really.
The book doesn't pull any punches about our history. You say in it that the first Australians were a people on the verge of extinction in the early 20th century. So 100 years ago, Aboriginal Australians were, in your view, absolutely hanging by a thread.
That's right. It's well documented. I think the official count at one part of the early 20th century was 30,000 so-called full-blood Aborigines were estimated to be in existence. And demographers have done some research and estimate that the 1788 Aboriginal population was at least 1 million people. So that is a terrible population decline.
Do you think that Australians of non-Indigenous background, even today, fully grasp what it means to have had a population that crossed the entire nation being winnowed down to 30,000?
No, I don't think many Australians are aware of that part of our history. And that's very unfortunate. And that's why I do raise these issues in the book, because whether you're Australian or whether you're from another country, if you turn up in an Aboriginal area and start asking questions without an understanding of the history that's gone before it, it could be very embarrassing, not just for the visitor, but also for the traditional owners. You know, it causes great pain to people to have to answer questions from people who have no understanding of our history. And that's why I felt that it was essential to explain some of that history so that people are mindful, you know, having a regard for the feelings of their hosts.
Well, Stan Grant, in his book, Talking to My Country, put up the view that he believed that the trauma of what happened in that 150 years after 1788 is so profound that it can never wash away from the Aboriginal experience in Australia, no matter how many generations pass. It's quite a bleak prospect that the trauma will track down through the generations almost in perpetuity. Do you have that view?
Yes. Australia has the distinction of being the nation with the highest language extinction rate in the world. There were 600 language varieties in Australia, and now I'm not sure how many one would count as surviving languages. So many are very much endangered, and each year we lose more languages as older people pass away, who are the last speakers of those languages. We do have language revitalisation projects, and some of these are very successful, actually. So it's important to understand why some people don't speak their language, because the languages became extinct in the 19th century during the course of those terrible frontier times.
Mm. You are an example of someone who has found a way and a place in Australia. You grew up in a dirt-floored humpy, to use a phrase that you have used, and you have pulled up others behind you and in a straight-talking way. And one of those is Stan Grant himself, who has said that he had a part-time job pushing trolleys around at the Australian Institute of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Studies in Canberra when he bumped into you there. Here's how he tells that encounter.
Marcia was a young researcher then, and she was doing her PhD, I think, at the time at ANU. And she pulled me aside one day in the library and she said, "Look, what are you doing with your life? You finished school. Your parents did not sacrifice everything they did to get you that education for you to just fritter it away, wandering around aimlessly delivering mail." She said, "You've got to have ambition. You're a smart kid and you can do things." She turned up a couple of days later with the university application forms and she'd filled it all in. She said, "Sign this."
So you put a fire under Stan Grant, and within a few years he was running a nationally televised current affairs program in prime time. So you're obviously pretty good at that mentoring business. How important is it, do you think, for young Aboriginal people to have someone who will look out for them and will, in a way, forge a path ahead for them so that they can reach their full potential in Australia?
Let me put it this way, Hugh. More than half the Aboriginal population, and many Torres Strait Islanders as well, don't have the social capital that other Australians take for granted, because our peoples were excluded from Australian life for so many decades, and our ability to participate in Australian society, in the economy, in the institutional life of Australia has really only started to grow in the last, I would say, two decades. So when I was at the ANU at the time that Stan was talking about, there were only two Aboriginal students. And before that, when I was a student at the University of Queensland, I was one of two Aboriginal students at that university. Now we have thousands of Aboriginal University graduates and Torres Strait Islander University graduates, including PhDs. We have a very large qualified Indigenous health workforce. We have a numbers of Indigenous professional associations, such as the Australian Indigenous Doctors Association. There are quite a number of associations for lawyers, both for solicitors and barristers. And while the numbers are small, especially in the non-traditional careers such as dentistry, architecture, accounting, I think we've reached a tipping point where if we just keep going now, it won't be so far away when we do start to reach parity in a number of fields. And I would not be in the position that I'm in today without very kind people helping me when I first started to study at the ANU in 1978. I didn't finish my degree at the University of Queensland because it was so racist back then, but I did finish my degree at the Australian National University because of very kind people who were not Aboriginal, but who just thought, well, they could see that I needed a hand and they made sure that I got the assistance that I needed.
I want to ask you about when you were still very young. You took off to Asia and travelled around with your young son, Ben. And you've said that you found yourself free of endless daily racism. To Asians, you said, "I wasn't black." How important is it? How sad is it? That because Stan Grant has said similar things about moving overseas and being able to be, in a sense, relieved of the burden of being an Aboriginal who has to take the racism but also try to find their own way. He just becomes another human being on the planet like everyone else on the planet, and that becomes a hugely liberating event. That was your experience as well, I think.
Yes. And, you know, even now when I'm absolutely sick of the racism in Australia, I just get on a plane and go somewhere and it's just absolutely liberating. One day I must find the words to write about it because it's very difficult to describe. You know, I don't use public transport at all, except in emergencies.
Why not?
Because I don't want to be harassed.
And what would be the harassment that you would expect to encounter?
Well, I was shoved off a tram in Melbourne once. or people who recognise me from a television interview and come up and start an argument with me, and also being refused service by taxi drivers, being refused service in various types of establishments. I was asked recently in a shop in, you know, one of these chains that sell women's clothing, when I handed over my credit card, if it was my credit card. That was at the Melbourne airport.
Yeah. It's funny because it's not funny, but we see that the issue which you deeply studied in the course of your work with the Royal Commission into Aboriginal deaths in custody back in the 1980s and early 90s, that we still have a situation where 27% of Australia's prison population is Aboriginal or Torres Strait Islander, 27% out of a population that's actually only 3% of the population, and that incarceration rate has increased 41% over the last decade. So it is bad and getting worse, despite absolutely everything. Is there a way out of that?
Oh, yes. And there were more than 300 recommendations of the Royal Commission into Aboriginal Deaths in Custody. And the primary one was imprisonment as a last resort. And no one takes any notice of it. And so the entire schema for preventing the unnecessary incarceration of Indigenous people was set out in that Royal Commission report, and it has been set out in every similar report since, including the Royal Commission into the Youth Detention Centre in the Northern Territory recently. And the same things are said over and over again, and basically the problem remains the same, and that is that police forces around Australia criminalise Aboriginal people for the crime of, and this is the standing joke in the Aboriginal world, walking while black.
Now, last year there was the Uluru Statement from the Heart. In it was the sentence, "We call for the establishment of a First Nations voice enshrined in the Constitution. It has gone politically absolutely nowhere." How important is it that that gets back on track?
I think it's vital. If the Uluru Statement from the Heart is not dealt with in a formal way and in a considered way by an Australian government, then I think we will see the disillusionment of our leadership. I certainly feel very disillusioned by the way that this present government has treated the Uluru Statement from the Heart. And I know many, many people who do feel the same way that I do. And there was a poll last year, and it reported that 61% of the people polled supported the Uluru Statement from the Heart. And I believe, from what I am observing, that the numbers now are even higher. And I hope that politicians and other Australian leaders rally around and help us to achieve a referendum on this question. And the constitutional entrenchment of a voice to Parliament, the Makarrata as a treaty commission, and truth-telling.
You name 1971 as the year that made you. Why that year?
I had been in Asia, as you said, and it was during the Vietnam War. And it's was the first televised war, as you know, and utterly shocking for me as a young person. And it was absolutely unnecessary. It was an unjust war. And I think Americans have ever since been trying to come to terms with their defeat and why they were there in the first place. And of course, what they did in neighbouring countries was just as bad and possibly worse. And I saw at first hand the terrible impact of that war on people. And we now know that the people in charge were lying. They were all lying.
And in the middle of it all came the sublime voice of Marvin Gaye, What's Going On? What was it about this song that struck with you?
Well, that was the a song about Vietnam. It was a song about African Americans who had served in Vietnam coming home to their country, and it was absolutely devastating for them. They were cannon fodder, and they were sent to overseas to murder people who were not their enemy.
Indeed. Marcia Langton, great to talk to you. I could talk all day, but we can't. So here's Marvin Gaye.
Thanks, Hugh.
Mother, mother, there's too many of you crying. Brother, 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 there's far too many of you dying. You know we've got to find a way to bring some love. Don't need to escalate. You see, war is not the answer, for only love can conquer hate. You know we've got to find a way to bring some loving here today. Oh, picket lines and picket signs. Punish me sister, with brutality sister, talk to me sister, so you can see sister, oh, what's going on,
what's going on,
what's going on,
what's going on,
yeah, what's going on,
what's going on,
oh, what's going on,
what's going on,
oh, right,
they judge us simply cause our hair is long.
Oh, you know that we've got to find a way.
Bring some understanding here today. Oh, oh, oh. Picket lines and picket signs. Don't punish me with brutality. Come on, talk to me. You can't see what's going on. Yeah, what's going on? Tell me what's going on. I'll tell you what's going on.
Right, right on. Right on. Right.